Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 33. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. What force do bankers have on our society and government? Do the banks really control the world? Do global conspiracies really exist? Or are these just traps of weak-minded, tin-hat-wearing fools? If the conspiracies really do exist, then who benefits? Is the U.S. Federal Reserve really a branch of the U.S. government? And how is money created? What does the future hold for our economy and global politics? Today I thought that I'd do a show that's entirely different from the usual format. This is very pertinent information to understanding what's going on right now in the U.S. and the world with Bush and Obama's bailouts and how the entire thing is a scam to protect the bankers who caused this situation and milk the public through a hidden tax called inflation. Today's guest is G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. This is a fantastic and detailed interview at 1 hour and 40 minutes, and I have to thank Edward for offering the show a longer and more detailed interview than he normally provides. So please make sure you listen to the entire show, and you won't be disappointed. There is a lot of meaty information in this interview and some underlying themes that some of you more research in this area we'll pick up on as well. Upcoming shows, Professor Benny Shannon from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Israel, and author of Antipodes of the Mind, which is a book on ayahuasca. And as far as interviews after that, I'm not totally sure who I'm going to have on week after next. It could be Stephen Hager from High Times Magazine, or Judith Ann Brown, who is the daughter of John Marco Allegro, or possibly Richard Tarnas regarding his latest book. And I've also discussed with Acharya S. about doing another show in the very near future to discuss her recent ebook release and some comments that have been going around recently about her work and our work on mushrooms and if there are differences or if they work together and stuff like that. So we thought that that would be a important topic to discuss as well, so look forward to that in the very near future. And we still need help with transcription, so if you can help on that for these shows, that is greatly appreciated. And maybe you're interested in helping, but you can't afford to donate right now, so this is a fantastic way to help. Please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And things have really slowed down lately. We haven't had any donations. So again, I ask for your support to the show and this programming. And as always, we greatly appreciate your support, and it allows us to continue doing this important work. And by donating each week or each month, you're helping get this information out to the world. So if you consider this type of work important as I do, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. And you can also donate from the donation button on the gnosticmedia.podomatic.com website. And you can also support this show by ordering a copy of the DVD or one of my books or the She Who Remembers audio archives from the Gnostic Media website. Astrotheology and Shamanism, Christianity's Pagan Roots, which I co-authored with Andrew Rutaji. I still have 46 copies left of that in the color, numbered, and signed edition, and that does come with a free Pharmacredit Inquisition DVD. And you can also get yourself ANS in black and white. It's much cheaper than the color edition, but that one is not numbered. Just be aware of that. I also have copies of The Holy Mushroom available on the website, and those do go out autographed as well in appreciation for your support. And as always, we really do appreciate all of your support, however you can contribute. So please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and check things out there. You can also participate on the forum and things like that. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. And once again, the website, GnosticMedia.com, or you can email me directly at contact@GnosticMedia.com. Enjoy the show.
Hello.
Yes, Edward.
Yes, speaking.
Yes, this is Jan Irvin. How are you doing today?
Good, Jan. How are you doing?
Good. I'm excited to have you on the show. I've been studying your work and a lot of other good stuff lately, so hopefully we can make a great interview today.
Well, I'll do my best.
Well, Edward, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself? What is your background and that good sort of stuff?
Sure. My background is not particularly impressive. I'm basically a writer, a researcher. I've been writing ever since about 1962, I think, is when I started. I never thought of myself as a writer. I went to school and learned basic communication skills as in public speaking and that kind of thing, oral skills, radio, and then later in television. But I had an illness years ago when I was young, and I was confined to bed for a period of time. And I had been speaking on the topic of the United Nations prior to that. And a publisher that I was acquainted with and done some work with contacted me and asked me to write a book on this topic. Well, I told him I didn't think I was a good writer. In fact, I'd never written anything of consequence. But I really didn't have much choice, Jan. I was confined to bed, and I thought, well, this is a way to help support my family, put groceries on the table. So I gave it a try. And much to my amazement, I enjoyed it. And the publisher seemed to like it. And so from that day forward, I've been writing away. And fortunately, we find some readers out there that think it's worth reading. So basically, I'm just a guy that is curious about a lot of things in the universe, and especially our universe here. And I write about things that I consider to be important not only to me and my family, but to our country and to mankind. I have a lot of interests that I don't write about because they're not important. For example, I'm a great model railroad enthusiast, but that doesn't seem to be very important in the great world.
Well, or at least maybe for a niche market it would be.
Yeah, for a niche market and all that sort of thing. But so I've written on items that affect our nation, our economy, our freedom, our knowledge of ourselves and our history and so forth. I've even done a little dabbling in issues that relate to Earth history and the origins of mankind. But mostly my focus, Jan, has been on the field of freedom issues and health issues, because I consider to be that, our freedom and our health, they sound like they're somewhat vastly different, but they're so closely intertwined, because if we have freedom and we don't have the health to enjoy it, life is rather unfulfilling. And if we have health, but we don't have freedom to enjoy the health, it's equally unfulfilling. So I think, man needs both. I've always been drawn to those topics. So I've written on things relating to the drugless control of disease and natural health. And that seems to be where I've been drawn in everything I've touched in the field of cancer, for example. I've written a book on cancer. And then in the field of freedom issues, one of my greatest concerns is the loss of freedom, especially here in the United States. Many parts of the world, of course, have never enjoyed freedom of any substantial degree, and they don't really suffer the loss of it. But here in the United States, we're seeing freedom rapidly disappearing, and that's of great concern to me. And, of course, with the loss of freedom, we have the counterbalance there, which is the growth of government and the growth of coercion in our lives. So those are the things that attract me, and those are the things that I've been writing about. I produced a couple of documentary films along the way and a couple of books, and that's about it.
And speaking of your books, probably the one that is familiar to most of the listeners out there is your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. How did you get involved in studying the Federal Reserve System?
Well, years ago, Jan, I had decided that I wanted to do a documentary film on inflation, the cause of inflation, and how to stop it. And, of course, anybody that seriously looks at that topic is led directly to the engine of inflation, which is the Federal Reserve System. That's the institution that makes inflation possible, or I should say makes it inevitable. So I started to do some research on that, and I acquired a couple of banker boxes full of books and documents and notes and so forth. And I never did finish the documentary. I was sidetracked on some other issues. But several years after that, I was invited to speak at a Pasadena, California meeting. Some ladies there had a group studying taxes, and it was a study group, and they wanted me to give a talk on taxes. And I told the ladies, I said, well, you know, I don't know much about taxes except that they're too high and I don't like them. But other than that, I don't have any great insight. But I do know something about an invisible tax called inflation. Would you like me to talk about that? And they said, sure, that'd be great. Actually, they were just looking primarily for a free speaker, I think. So anybody to speak on any topic was welcome. And so I did. I pulled my boxes out and kind of went through them. I made some notes and cobbled up together a presentation. And they liked it a lot. In fact, the people there were so encouraging to me to take it on the road, they said. So that's, you know, it's heady stuff when your audience is really like what you're saying. So I decided maybe this topic was important enough to shine it up, polish it up, and take it on the road, which I did. I started to give a series of speeches on the Federal Reserve System. And eventually I decided I didn't know enough about it, because at the end of each of my talks, although I knew quite a bit about the Federal Reserve, I didn't know that much about the real world of economics, the markets, the investments, and so forth. And people inevitably at the end of my lectures would come up and say, well, what do you think I should do with my money? I've got my money over here, and should I put it over there to protect it, and so forth? And I felt so inadequate that I couldn't even talk intelligently. These people knew more about investments than I did. So I stopped giving the lectures, and I enrolled in a school, the College for Financial Planning in Denver, and decided it was time to get an education on these things. And so I went for a few years there. It was a correspondence course, and I got my CFP designation, a Certified Financial Planner, not because I wanted to be a financial planner, because I didn't want to be that, and I never have been that. But I took the course because I just wanted to learn about the real markets out there. And then, after that, I began to write my book, and that was the beginning of a seven-year project. And finally, 7 years after that, the book was finally written. So you see, it evolved over a period of probably 12 years. And had I known at the beginning what it was going to involve, I never would have started to take that journey.
Well, you know, and it's funny because your journey is very similar to my own. I've had some stomach problems. I often find myself lying in bed and start writing a book. And, you know, actually I just moved from Simi Valley about 4 or 5 minutes from you.
Yeah.
And so... very familiar with the whole scene over there and everything, and it's your story is very compatible to my own. So let me ask you this, and I write books and I'm a researcher as well too. Maybe I should start out first by asking you to describe what exactly is fiat money.
Yeah, that's a word that gets bandied around quite a bit. Fiat money is based on the French word fiat, meaning to command or to bring about by government decree. It's just a fiat. The king or the emperor decrees something, and by fiat it is accomplished. So when applied to money, it means money which is decreed to be money by the government. That's technically what it means. But when it's used in economics, it generally has a deeper meaning because the kind of money that needs a decree to force people to accept it is always money that has no value otherwise, that people would never voluntarily accept. Otherwise, it wouldn't need a decree. If money were gold or silver, you wouldn't have to decree that people accept it. They're willingly accepted. So when you have this fiat or decree money that you must accept or go to prison, then that's a pretty good clue that the money has no other value except the coercion power of the state behind it. So in a nutshell, fiat money is money which is worthless, has nothing of intrinsic value that is behind it, and which you must accept under punishment of prison, other penalties of the state.
So it's sort of almost like a religion in a way.
Well, in a way, I guess you could say it. It was a religion. It has become a religion.
Well, yeah,
I was just going to add that it's
based on belief, really, and not only that, but the king's order, the government's order. But other than that, it's based on belief.
Well, it's based on belief that you better accept it or you're going to go to jail. But, you know, many people don't really think that deeply about it. They believe that the money is going to be accepted by someone else. I guess in that sense it's belief, and they're true, because everybody must accept fiat money. Everyone who lives in the kingdom or within the jurisdiction of the government which has decreed the money into existence. And so there's a certain amount of faith that if you accept this Federal Reserve note, in this case, that's what we have in this country, and even though it doesn't have any gold or silver backing behind it, you have faith, you believe that others will accept it from you, because they have to, because that's just the law. The legal tender laws are always there to force people to accept fiat money. And after a while, people, especially those who have gone through school and studied economics and perhaps gotten a degree in banking and economic theory, they actually come out of that process believing that that is the best possible system, because they believe that if they didn't force people to accept worthless money, and if money was really backed by something of tangible value, such as gold or silver, they believe that there wouldn't be enough of it available to go around. They believe that therefore the economy would stagnate, and therefore they believe that fiat money is the best possible money. So in that sense, it's kind of like a religion. But all of those beliefs are contrary to history. They're contrary to common sense and to logic. But in that sense, I would have to say that it is like a religion.
Describe what is the Federal Reserve, and also, why does the Federal Reserve have 12 branches? That seems to me to... To going back to religion again, that whole 12 thing reminds me of the 12 tribes of Dan and the 12 signs of the zodiac and the 12 all over the place. Why? What is the Fed and why the 12?
Well, maybe I ought to start with the tail end of that question first and say quite honestly that I'm not aware of any occult rationale for 12 branches, although there very well may be. I do know that 12 is a common number, and people like, they just respond to the number 12 psychologically. But I'm not aware in any of my research, Jan, that the number 12 was chosen for any reason other than that it was just a popular number. However, the other question is far more documentable, and that is, what is the Federal Reserve System? Many people think that, as I did in the beginning, think that the Federal Reserve is a government agency and that it's there to protect the financial interests of the American people, to stabilize the currency, and to stimulate the economy. It's none of those things. When you really dig into it, you find to your amazement that the Federal Reserve System is a cartel. It's no different than an oil cartel or a banana cartel, sugar cartel, happens to be a banking cartel. It's made up of the largest banking companies in the United States, and I might add with very strong ties to banking consortia in Europe as well. But it's primarily an American institution with the largest banks of New York dominating it, coming together, forming a cartel among themselves, and then having the brilliant strategic foresight to take their cartel agreement and convince the idiots in Congress to pass it into law. Basically, the Federal Reserve Act, if you really read it with your eyes wide open, you realize that it's nothing but a cartel agreement, but written in the verbiage of law. And this is, I think, a very brilliant strategy on their part, because, you see, one of the problems with any cartel is how to discipline the members of the cartel and force them to keep their agreement. You can imagine that if we were dealing with an oil cartel, for example, and some of the boys over in Mexico or over in Saudi Arabia or someplace else where they produce a lot of oil in Venezuela, they decide that they're not going to keep the agreement anymore. They all agreed to fix their prices, you know, to stabilize the price and get more money out of the system. But all of a sudden, one of the boys decides, well, no, we need more money. We're not getting our fair share of the market. So we're going to lower our price of oil, which we easily can do, in order to get a bigger part of the market and make more profit. So they will break the cartel agreement. Well, what's the rest of the cartel going to do about it? They can't do anything about it. Well, of course, we know that sometimes they resort to illegal means and what we might consider to be underworld tactics. There is foul play sometimes used, but normally that's not the case. They just have to use persuasion and get all the members back into agreement again. Well, now, if they took that cartel agreement and passed it into law, now if one of the members breaks away from the agreement, they're breaking the law. And they go to prison. So cartels always have an affinity for government. They like to bring government into the partnership, into the cartel, so that they can enforce their cartel agreement. And that is exactly what happened when the Federal Reserve Act was written in 1913, or passed into law in 1913. So when you stand back and recognize what the Federal Reserve really is, it takes on a whole different appearance. Instead of thinking of it as something there to protect the American people, we realize that it's there to do what all cartels are there to do, and that is to protect the interests of the members of the cartel, period. Now, I'm sure that the banks that constitute the cartel don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, and they'd like to see America prosper. But if it comes push to shove between the interests of the American people and the interests of the banks, you can be sure that the Federal Reserve System will make all decisions to favor the interests of the members of the banks. And all you have to do is read today's headlines to see how true that is. The Federal Reserve has stepped into line, and it's just created tremendous sums of money out of thin air, which means it'll be passed on to the taxpayers in the form of inflation. And they're just shoveling it into the banks as fast as they can, all the time saying, well, we're doing this for the economy. We're doing this for you folks. But, you know, it's a banking cartel. So once you understand what the Federal Reserve System is, then all of this smoke gets cleared away, all of these this rhetoric of the chairman of the Federal Reserve System and all of the defenders of the system, all the bankers and all the financiers. You see right through their rhetoric instantly. The Federal Reserve System is a banking cartel.
Fascinating. And, you know, some of what you were saying there regarding oil and a member of the cartel breaking away and lowering their prices to garner more of the market, I just couldn't help but thinking about some of Hugo Chavez's recent actions in Venezuela doing exactly that. And offering oil much cheaper than the competition.
Yes, and there's nothing they can do about it. Of course, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, Chavez is not in the same cartel that the American oil companies are.
He's not in OPEC.
Not in OPEC. So they have no influence over him whatsoever. But that is one of the reasons, by the way, why the very top financiers and cartelists, let's just use that word in this case, are always in favor of international government and international treaties, because what they want to do is make their cartel agreements enforceable by international law. Now, they do have some control over Chavez or everybody else on the planet who breaks away from the agreement. They can send the United Nations so-called peacekeepers in there and just take over the government. So that's the ultimate.
They did try and do that to Chavez in 2002, but lucky for him, a million people came out of their houses and threw the coup out of office and brought him back into power. So it's probably, as far as a populist movement, one of the most successful counter attempts at a coup that I've ever come across. Tell me, who started the Fed? Who or what families were behind the creation of the Fed?
Well, it's pretty clear from the record of the time when the meeting took place on Jekyll Island back in 1910, which is the place and the time when the Federal Reserve System was actually conceived. A little parenthetical aside there is that the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, but the real planning and the organization took place 3 years prior to that, 1910, on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia, which was a private island. It was owned by a small group of billionaires from New York. It was called the Jekyll Island Club, and it was a resort island, and it was a place where the very super wealthy families went to spend the cold winter months on Jekyll Island, and they had beautiful mansions there and a big clubhouse. And that's where they went to form the Federal Reserve System away from the prying eyes of the world, certainly away from Washington, D.C. And the families and the, really, it's not so much the families, but the institutions that were behind that were J.P. Morgan and the Rockefeller Consortia. Those are the two major ones. The investment house of Kuhn, Loeb & Company was very, very, very much involved. And, of course, they had representation of vast pools of money in Europe, primarily with the Rothschild banking dynasty and the Warburg banking dynasty. But nevertheless, it was represented in this country in the form of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. So there you have it. It was just a very super powerful institutions on Wall Street that had coalesced all of this money. As a matter of fact, the estimate of the wealth that was held by the men that went to Jekyll Island to create the Federal Reserve System, at the time this was done in the newspapers, which I dug out, they estimated that those guys, those seven men that went to Jekyll Island, represented directly or indirectly through the banking institutions which they represented about one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world. I mean, an incredible concentration of wealth into this little group that created the Federal Reserve System. And you know, Jan, the incredible thing, the ironic thing about all of this is that the American people were told that the Federal Reserve Act was written to, and this was a phrase from the period, to break the grip of the money trust. That was a political slogan. It was very popular in 1913, and Americans were convinced that passing the Federal Reserve Act was going to break the grip of the money trust over the economy of the nation. And the irony is that the men who wrote the Federal Reserve Act were the money trust. And that's the reason, by the way, they went to Jekyll Island to do it under conditions of great secrecy, which is I've unraveled in my book. I mean, they denied that they went. They even used code names on board the train that they traveled so that nobody would know who all these people were. It was just like they were plotting a surprise attack for a war. A great secrecy. And the reason for that secrecy is that if the American people had known that the money trust had written the bill, which was supposed to break the grip of the money trust, well, the scam would have been out in the open and it wouldn't never have been passed.
And J.P. Morgan and some of these guys is actually where my work overlaps with your work, and in part what led me to your work is, I don't know, you may not have heard of him, but one of J.P. Morgan's vice presidents was a man by the name of Gordon Wasson, and I've been researching Gordon Wasson's background, and it's quite a fascinating tale. So, you know, in a way, what you're presenting today is the other side of this man, Gordon Wasson, who most of my audience is very familiar with, and what he was doing in the other part of his life that is usually not discussed in the dozens of books that are out there written about him and his life. Tell me, if you would go into exactly how does the Federal Reserve work?
Yes, that's the key, isn't it? That's where the rubber meets the road, as they say. The Federal Reserve System, remember, is a cartel. I have to keep saying that because when you look at those buildings, those mausoleum-type buildings that constitute those 12 regional branches, they look like banks, but they're not. They look like they've got money in them, and most of them do not. They're just office buildings. That's basically what they are, and they've got the guards around there, and boy, you think this is where the money is. And they're really guarding something. It's mostly for show. The Federal Reserve System is a cartel. And as such, it's a regulatory body. It's a directorate. They determine policy. Oh, I'm sure they clear checks. They serve as a check clearinghouse. And they have some technical functions, to be sure. But the real action where the money moves is not really at the Federal Reserve System. Let me give you an example of how money comes into creation, this fiat money, as we call it, comes into creation through the Federal Reserve System. A moment ago, we mentioned the fact that the Fed is a cartel and it has a partner, and the partner is the federal government. Well, in a partnership, there have to be advantages to both partners or they wouldn't be in it. So, let's take a look very briefly to see what the advantage is to the government partner, and then we'll see what the advantage is to the banking partner. And therein, you'll figure out how the Federal Reserve System works and really what the whole scam is about. Let's start with the government side. The government needs money. Governments always need lots of money, as modern governments anyway, especially those that are built on the model of collectivism, where they believe that they should be providing benefits for the people. Politicians like to provide benefits, 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 more benefits to get votes, 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 more votes. But then they have to pay for those benefits, and that means taxes, 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 more taxes, and so forth. Well, that's the bad side. Politicians want benefits, but they don't want to raise taxes, because if they do that, they get unelected. So the trick then is, how can you raise how do you provide benefits without raising taxes? Well, everybody knows the answer to that one is that is you borrow the money. If you can't afford something and you don't have any means of increasing your income, then you borrow the money. So the government sells bonds and it goes into debt. This way, now the politicians can provide benefits for this year and next year without increasing taxes for this year and next year. But unfortunately, the debt has to be repaid, the bonds mature, and the government has to pay back the money they borrowed plus interest. Well, lo and behold, when that happens, they don't want to raise taxes, but by this time they've increased their spending for more benefits. So they don't have the money to pay back those bonds. In fact, they need even more money than they did previously. No problem. They simply borrow more money, first of all, to pay off the old bonds, and then new money for the new benefits. So they keep going deeper and deeper into debt. Everybody understands this. This is the origin of the national debt. And these politicians really don't ever expect to be alive when the debt has to be repaid. And in fact, the more savvy of them know that the debt will, in fact, never be repaid. It's just a mechanism. But we come back to that perhaps later. For now, let's play along with the myth and say that the debt must be repaid. So they keep going into debt, deeper and deeper into debt. However, that is never enough, because in order to borrow all of the money that it really needs to provide that expansion of benefits, the public sector is not willing to put up that much money, even for government bonds, at the interest rates which the government is willing to pay. So there's always a shortfall. They cannot borrow enough money this year or this month or this day. What are they going to do? Okay, this is where the Federal Reserve comes in. For the shortfall, they go to the Federal Reserve system and they say, we want to borrow some money from you because we can't get it from the public sector. The Federal Reserve system says, well, no problem. How much money do you want today? And let's say the Treasury official says, another $1 billion would be just fine for today. The Federal Reserve officer says, no problem. He opens up his desk. Well, not really. This is all done in computers. But just to visualize the process, imagine right. He pulls out a big black checkbook, and he writes a check to the government, to the Treasury, for $1 billion. And he signs it. Bingo. The government's got it. This check. The government then takes it downstairs to the window and deposits it into the government's checking account as a deposit for $1 billion. Bingo, the government now has this money. The question arises then, where did the Federal Reserve System get that $1 billion to lend, supposedly, to lend to the federal government? And the answer is, it didn't get it from anywhere. There were no depositors. There's no account. The money was created out of thin air at the instant that loan was made. Out of thin air. Now, if you and I were to do that, of course, we'd go directly to jail. But they can do that because, remember, this is a partnership between the government and the cartel.
Right.
And the government wants them to be able to do that so that the government can get any amount of money it needs with no limit without having to go to the taxpayers and tax them directly for it. And we see that today where almost every session of Congress, they're voting billions, if not trillions of dollars, and nobody ever questions, where is this money coming from? Who's got it? Who's going to lend it? They don't have to question it because the Federal Reserve System will create it and is creating it out of thin air. So this expands the money supply greatly, as you can imagine.
Right.
So that's the reason the government is in the partnership, because it now has instant access to an unlimited amount of money for any purpose it may want. Now, why are the banks in this thing? Why do they do that? Well, if you think that the action so far is interesting, wait till you see this next part. Let's just assume that, let's follow $1,000 of that money that was created, that $1 billion that they just created for the government. Let's follow $1,000 of it as a paycheck to the postal worker that delivers our mail. Okay, he's now got a government check for $1,000. He takes it down the street and deposits it into his private checking account in the Bank of Hoboken or wherever it is. And now the money is out of the government Federal Reserve System side, and it's into the commercial banking side. It's now a deposit into a commercial bank. Now, if I were the president of that bank, I could stand up in front of everybody there in the lobby and say, attention, everybody, I have some good news. This gentleman over here just deposited $1,000 into our venerable bank. And everybody's very happy to hear that because they know that the more money my bank has, the more money we can loan. And if we have lots of money to loan, the interest rates generally go down. And so people are glad to hear that my bank has got all this money. And someone may say, well, how much do you have? And I might say, well, he deposited $1,000. And then the borrower might say, well, that's not enough. I need $9,000. I'm looking at this used car for my wife, and I really want $9,000, so I guess you can't help me. As a banker, I would say, wait a minute, sir, don't leave. I can help you. I can loan you $9,000. And the borrower would say, on $1,000? And I would say, yes. And right. No matter how, and the borrower might say, how can you do that? And I would say, don't worry about it. It's all legal. It's all arranged. It's all taken care of by the Federal Reserve System. And the bottom line is this, Jan, that I can, on the basis of $1,000 deposited into my bank, I can loan an additional $9,000. That, too, comes out of thin air. That
right.
is not in my in my account. So we start with $1,000 out of thin air, and that becomes the basis for an additional $9,000 out of thin air, and now you begin to see how money comes into existence in the American banking system.
Right. And I excuse me, and I had always thought it worked a little bit differently. You just clarified that for me. I had always thought that if you deposited $1,000, the bank could loan out $900 of that, and they had to keep $100. But you're saying it's quite the opposite. They take that $1,000, they can create another $8,000-$9,000 on top of that.
Well, believe it or not, Jan, both statements are true. The version I gave you is the short version. That's the end result. The way it actually happens is sometimes called the revolving door mechanism. The bank does keep $100, loan out $9, but then that $9 goes out and comes back in as another deposit, you see.
Right.
And then they keep 10% of that and loan out 90% of it. And that goes out and then comes back in as another deposit, and it goes around and around and around, revolving door. And that plays out after about 14 times out and back. Then the differential is so small you can hardly measure it. But after about 14 times, then the net result is what I said, that the bank literally creates an additional $9,000. So both statements are true. But the net effect is that for every $1 billion created out of thin air and loaned to the federal government, an additional $9 billion can be created out of thin air at the commercial banks and loaned to private borrowers and corporations and institutions. Now, remember, the banks charge interest on this. That means interest on nothing. And that is an amazing thought. The more you think about that, the banks say, well, we only collect, you know, a couple of percent interest on the money deposited. They don't tell you how much interest they collect on money that was not deposited, but in fact created out of thin air. So you take their normal interest rate and you multiply it by about 9 and sometimes more. Now you have the real interest rate on the money that's deposited in the banks. So what's the effect of this? This is one of the most amazing schemes that you could possibly imagine, and it all has been going on under our noses for our whole lifetime. And we've always been, you know, told that banking is a very conservative, a very prestigious, a very honorable, equitable institution, you know, honesty first and so forth, and this whole thing is based on a scam. You say, how does the Federal Reserve System work? Well, that's how it works. It creates money out of nothing, it charges interest on nothing, and it's never enough. They want more, more, and more. Consequently, the banks, being in partnership with the federal government, they know that they can afford to make risky loans. All they care about is the interest. They really don't want people to pay back loans, because if you pay back the loan, they just have to go out and find some other customer to borrow, because they don't make money unless they've loaned money out. So they don't really want you to pay back your loan. They just want you to keep paying the interest on the loan. So they can afford to make risky loans to giant corporations or to third world countries, risky loans that they think, you know, they may never pay us back, knowing that if the companies they loan to or the countries they loan to are big enough, then they start to default, they can always go to Congress and they say, well, Mr. Congressman, you know, we can't afford to let General Motors go out of business, because look at all those employees that will lose their jobs, the families that will they'll go hungry, the babies won't have milk, and the economy will suffer, and so forth. And so please, Congress, vote the money. Get the Federal Reserve System to send the money to these corporations as a grant or a
perpetuating
bailout.
The problem.
And then they can continue paying us the interest on our loans. and the American people fall for it because they're so uninformed about the reality of the scam.
And speaking of all of that, in chapter 2 of your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, you titled it, The Name of the Game is Bailout. And, you know, with all of this money that Bush and Obama have been flooding into the economy, I just can't help but think of the repercussions that happened in Argentina when this happened. What was it, the 80s or 90s when their federal government did the same thing and it wiped out their country? And, you know, so I wanted you to talk to whatever extent you would like, hopefully quite a lot, because I actually got a few emails this week from people excited about you coming on the show, and one of them told me to make sure that you talked a lot about bailouts.
Well, I did just cover the main points a moment ago. The name of the game is bailout. The banks are protected by the government because they're in partnership with the government. That's the nature of the Federal Reserve Act. The banks know that no matter what happens to them, they're not going to be allowed to fail. They're going to be bailed out because that's the deal. That was the deal back in 1913 when they created this scam. And so the banks can do just about anything they want. They can make these risky loans. And they anticipate, as a matter of fact, that a lot of these loans, if not most of them, are going to fail. And so they decide, how can we prolong the process as long as possible? They know how it's going to end up, but they want to prolong the process. And so let's just say they want to loan $500 billion to some third world country. Let's just call it Hunza. That's a real country. I don't think they don't borrow any money, but let's assume Hunza decided they wanted to borrow $500 billion. The bank, let's say Citibank, is the one online. They send their young man out. He's probably pretty green on the force, and his job is real simple: is to talk the Prince of Hunza into accepting $500 billion. For development of water and electrical power and dams and agriculture and all of these wonderful things. And the Prince of Hunza says, this is wonderful, man. We've always wanted this. We could never afford this. And you're going to just give us this money? And this young man from Citibank says, sure, we do it all the time. This is how we're improving the world. You need the money. We've got the money. All we want is that, we want our 12% per annum or whatever the deal is. And, of course, if you don't repay, well, then we take over your country. But we won't talk about that now. And so the Prince of Hunza signs up for the deal. Now, Citibank knows, and bear in mind this is all hypothetical. You know, I'm not saying Citibank ever loaned a penny to Hunza. But right. In general, the bank that makes the loan is well aware that the probability of the country borrowing it is not going to be able to repay the loan. It'll be a miracle. They know that. But that's okay. They play the game. Now, 5 years, 6 years down the line, sure enough, the note comes due, and Hunza can't repay the loan. And so they send a more seasoned representative to Hunza this time. They said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to restructure the loan. We're going to loan you some more money. You owe us $500 billion now. We're going to loan you another $350 billion so that you can continue to pay us the interest out of that additional loan. Most of it will go to pay us back and the interest, and there'll be a little bit left over for you to continue to pay your salaries and to reward your political supporters. And maybe if there's a little bit left over, you might actually build a dam. And so they restructure the loan, and they know full well that another 3 or 5 years later, Hunza won't be able to pay that one back either. And so finally this process goes on, and each time the loan is restructured, and maybe the next time they lower the interest rate a little bit, so they're looking good all the way along the line. And finally, 10, 15 years down the line, the whole thing just falls apart. And that's where the International Monetary Fund steps in. Now, they will provide funding and regulations to Hunza, say, all right, we will guarantee these loans. We recognize that you can't pay them, but we will now guarantee these loans on your behalf so that you can continue to pay the interest to the bank. And the International Monetary Fund now comes up with huge amounts of money. And where did that money come from? Well, it came from different countries that support it, the United States being the major one, which means it comes from the American taxpayers. So the American taxpayer, without even knowing that he's doing it, is indirectly sending a lot of his hard-earned money to the International Monetary Fund through his own government, which voted for it. And that money then goes into Hunza, and Hunza sends the money back to Citibank, and around and around and around it goes, and Citibank is always doing well. No matter what happens to the American taxpayer or to the Prince of Hunza, Citibank is always getting its money. Finally, the whole thing collapses, and that's the scene we're seeing played out right now, where the taxpayer always is being called upon to produce the money to bail out everybody. This time, they're bailing out Citibank and everybody else. So that's the name of the game is bailout, and it's all done with a straight face. The players are there always talking about helping the economy, helping the American people, helping the people of Hunza. They're trying to develop a better way of life, a higher standard of living, and all of this rhetoric is there. Basically, I suppose some of them may believe it now and then, but most of it is rhetoric to hide the fact that the financial institutions are ripping off the planet and primarily ripping off the American taxpayer with the full cooperation of the United States Congress.
That's quite a story, to say the least. And, I lived in Yugoslavia and Serbia during the war there and got to witness the hyperinflation and all of this stuff. And then when the IMF came in, what they did was they basically forced Yugoslavia to hand over all of their assets to accept this loan. But it was because of the banks and the sanctions and the wars that bombed their industrial infrastructure that made them have to borrow all of this money to rebuild in the first place. So it was, the same sort of going around in circles, and it was just a complete farce. So now it's come home to roost instead of it being played out on other nations. Now the bankers are playing it out here at home.
That's right, and the American public is soon to pay a very heavy price for its own disinterest in these matters. Americans have been disinterested. They didn't care. As long as we live well, who cares,
Now, And that's the funny thing, too. It's like, in my own family, I've been telling them about this, and I've always called it the looming spider that the banking industry, and in my early 20s, I didn't really know how to explain it well, but I saw it as this looming spider with these legs that go out to infinity, and every time they loan out this money, they take 10% in and they loan out 90%. Every time they do that, this spider's legs get longer and longer and longer until finally it can't sustain its own weight, and then it collapses in on itself. And it's unfortunate because I feel like within my own family and things, I've been like a broken record for the last decade and a half. And when my parents contact me and ask me, well, hey, you were talking about this stuff, and it's now that it's too late to do anything, now you hear the message. But, what do you think of that? I mean, are we, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but do you think that we're in a position to still do something about this, or is it already too far gone?
That's a hard one to answer. I will say it's already too far gone to do anything easy. It's already gone too far that we can get out of it without paying a severe penalty. But it hasn't gone so far that we can't reverse it. We just have to recognize that there's going to be a price to pay. and we're going to have to pay the price. Because if we don't, it's going to get worse. And not only are we going to pay in the loss of economic power and standard of living, we're going to pay in the more dear coin of freedom. Because when the whole thing totally collapses and money is worthless and the commerce comes to a screeching halt, all that is left is martial law.
Right.
And you will do whatever the guys in the uniforms and the rifles tell you to do. And that's the worst. It's much better to take an economic hit. It's better to lose value. It's better to start over again in the spirit of freedom to rebuild. Because once you're in that concentration camp, then those options are gone. So yes, it can be done. And I think what we need now is a good recession. We need to clean out all this garbage, clean out all this fraud. That means there's going to be a price to pay. There's going to be one heck of a hangover after this binge. But the sooner we get on with it, the better off we're going to be.
Let me ask you this, and I always hear constantly from people that intellectualize and avoid. Well, you know what they do is, as it seems to me that people have been intellectually conditioned that when they hear the word conspiracy, they automatically reject it out of hand without actually looking at what the message is. So my question to you is, do conspiracies actually happen, and what is the history as far as governments and these things are concerned regarding conspiracies? Is that just thoughts of people who sit around and have too much time on their hands researching things, or is this real stuff here?
I have to laugh at this topic because I do know what you're saying, that many people do have a knee-jerk reflex to the word conspiracy, and they think that anybody that speaks of a conspiracy is some kind of a mental problem. But I feel sorry for those people because that tells me they've never read a history book. they ought to read some history because... The reality of history is that all of the major events through all time have been driven primarily by conspiracies of one kind or another.
Well, I can't think
of any exceptions.
Well, just think of all the emperors and all the kings and all these different countries that were conspired against and assassinated, or you hear of in Rome all of the Senate members. I forget which Caesar it was, but killing the Caesar. And, this happened often in Jerusalem and every kingdom throughout the world. They were always looking for their conspirators to take them out of power. And you talk a little bit about that in your book or one of your videos, but I see it as just a standard part of history. In fact, I would almost argue that history is run more than anything else on conspiracy.
Well, that's my point. Conspiracies are the norm, not the exception. And anybody that scoffs at conspiracies possibly existing today, I have to wonder what's going on inside their noggin. Today, especially in government, they'll believe that conspiracies may exist outside of government. That's pretty hard to argue against. I mean, you can go to any courtroom today, and if you sit there all day long, you're going to hear three or four cases involving conspiracies of one kind.
Right.
Conspiracies to defraud, conspiracies to violate a contract, conspiracies against consumers. I mean, conspiracies are everywhere. But then they say, well, but not in government. I mean, our trustworthy politicians would never be guilty of conspiracies, would they? And so it's kind of – when I hear somebody use that word conspiracy theory in a way to scoff at those who are talking about current events, I wonder what's going on with them. But nevertheless, I prefer not to use the word conspiracy if I don't have to, because it just does bring about that knee-jerk reaction.
Right.
But, conspiracies, what is a conspiracy? Okay. A conspiracy, according to any dictionary, different dictionaries have slightly different definitions, but there are three components that are common to them all. One is a conspiracy must involve two or more people. Secondly, the methods used by the conspirators must involve deceit or coercion. And thirdly, the object of the conspiracy must be illegal or immoral. Now, that's a conspiracy. If you can meet those three tests, you are dealing with a conspiracy. Well, what we're talking about here in the banking world, or if you want to even notch it up one level higher to the international arena of politics, you know, power politics, as including money, but also, you know, control over nations and political systems and that sort of thing, it certainly involves more than two people, doesn't it? So there, that takes care of number one. Number two, do these people use coercion or deceit? Boy, do they ever. And in fact, if you read some of my works, you can see I've pulled out their own works, their own words, in which they not only use deceit, but they say we have to use deceit because the people are too stupid. If we don't lie to them, they won't do what they're supposed to do. And they brag about the efficient engineering of public opinion, using false information and deceit and so forth. They brag about it, and they say it's wonderful because this is how we can manipulate people into doing what's correct. So that takes care of number two. Now, the only thing really left is the object of the conspiracy illegal or immoral or unethical? Well, this gets a little tough because for the most part, everything that these guys are doing is quite legal. As a matter of fact, they have written the laws to make it legal. The Federal Reserve Act, for example, is quite legal because it was passed into law by these people. So it's not illegal at all in most cases, although they're willing to break laws if necessary.
Even though the Federal Reserve Act violated the Constitution, didn't it?
Well, that's, yeah, now you're into a debate. Who says? Now you go to the Supreme Court, so forth. You know, the point is that the Federal Reserve Act itself is a legal document, so you can argue that it's not illegal. In fact, anybody who violates the terms of the Federal Reserve Act, those are the ones who are the criminals or the conspirators, and those are the ones who probably go to prison. So it's not really illegal in that sense. And so finally we're down to the phrase, well, is it unethical or immoral? Well, the people who are doing this do not think so. They think that what they are doing is the highest morality. They're trying to build what they finally call the New World Order. They think it's the highest morality, the best system, and is for your good and mine, whether we recognize it or not, and they are destined to be our rulers for our own benefit, for our own good. And so, therefore, they look at all of this as the highest morality.
Yeah, and they want to be Yahweh or something to
that
effect.
Yes.
They want to play God.
They actually believe that this is the best system, and if it's necessary to mess up a few lives or conquer a few countries or kill a few hundred thousand people along the way, it's for the greatest good of the greatest number, and it's for the best of society in the long run, so let's get on with it. And they see that as an act of high morality. Well, so there you have it. In their minds, it's not a conspiracy. But for most of us who are subject to this plan and have to pay the consequences of their so-called morality, I think we would call it immoral. And so I think most people are justified in using the word conspiracy.
Right.
But get off of the word conspiracy. I don't even care what you call it. We're talking about history. I am not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy historian. I like to look at facts.
An old a friend of mine that used to run a she died back in April of 2002. She used to run a show on KPFK in Los Angeles, and one of her favorite saying was her favorite saying was the opposite of conspiracy theory is coincidence theory.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, so these are these people advocate they're coincidence theorists. Okay, I don't care. the facts are facts, you know. And that, I think that we should get off of words which have emotional loading and get down to the actual facts. And when we talk about these people going to Jekyll Island in 1910 and going to great lengths to conceal the fact that they went and to lie about it and to use code names and all of that sort of thing. These are documentable facts, and when I say documented, I mean they're described by the participants themselves in their own books and in their own writings in later years. So
right.
This isn't just theory. These are facts.
Well, let me use the conspiracy as a segue here to jump into Hegelian theory. How does that apply to your work, the problem reaction solution theme?
You know, I have never really thought about that in terms of the Federal Reserve system. I'm sure that you could find plenty of evidences there.
I would think that that and Machiavellian theory from Machiavelli's book The Prince would be sort of core to how they play some of this stuff out.
Well, there's certainly a strong parallel to Machiavelli. I had always thought in my younger years that Machiavelli was an evil person, because every time his name was mentioned, it was in the sense of something evil being done. They'd say that was Machiavellian.
Yeah, and he was actually fighting against a lot of this stuff, wasn't he?
Well, when I finally read The Prince, I was amazed to find out that he really... he was a total pragmatist. It's not that he was an evil person. He was a pragmatist. And what he was basically saying to the prince, who was his employer, he was saying, look, prince, if you want to stay in power, this is what you have to do. Now, whether you like it or not, this is the way human nature is. This is how people will react. This is how your enemies will react. And if you can ignore this to your own peril. But this is what you must do. And I have to say that historically, he was correct. That doesn't mean you have to like it. So I see a lot of Machiavellian principles in the way that the engineers of the Federal Reserve System brought their program before the public. They were very Machiavellian. They knew exactly how their opponents would react and what to do about it, where to show mercy, when not to show mercy, and so forth. These guys were brilliant, and they still are. They're psychopoliticians. They understand the mass mind very well. I think back in the days when they were selling the Federal Reserve concept to the American people back in 1913, some of the bankers who had helped put together the program started giving speeches in which they condemned the Federal Reserve Act. They were condemning their own act in public. They were saying, this was not good for business. This is not good for America. This has serious flaws in it. And that was put into the newspapers. And the average person read that, and they would say, golly, these big bankers don't like the Federal Reserve Act very much. Must be pretty good. You know?
Yeah.
They were playing that game.
Right.
And they did it so well. These people are not stupid. They understand human psychology, and the average gum-chewing public is just, he doesn't have a chance against that kind of sophisticated opposition.
The average gum-chewing public, that's a very clever analogy. I've got to have you discuss somebody that's in your book that is probably one of the more important figures in history and maybe not enough recognized. Would you discuss Carol Quigley, who is the author of Tragedy and Hope, and discuss who he was and why he was important to your research?
Yes, Carol Quigley, I think, is a very interesting and important character. Carol Quigley, of course, it's a man. I have to hasten to say it because with a first name like Carol, it's very confusing, but he was a man. He's deceased now. He was a college professor at Georgetown University, very well known, prolific writer. He's written a couple of books, The Anglo-American Establishment and Tragedy and Hope are his primary works. He was a teacher of William Clinton when Clinton was a student at Georgetown. And Clinton and Quigley formed a very close bond. And as a matter of fact, when Clinton accepted the nomination for president at the Democratic Convention, in his acceptance speech, he acknowledged Professor Quigley and gave him credit for having formed his political thinking as a student. And after Clinton was already president, he also mentioned Quigley several times in his public speeches, so we know that Quigley was very important to Clinton. Well, many people would listen to Clinton's remarks and say, well, how nice that the president is giving honorable mention to a college professor who had a profound impact upon his career. How nice. Little did they know who Quigley was or what he was noted for. Quigley is considered to be the historian of one of the world's greatest conspiracies. He wrote about it. That was his book, Tragedy and Hope. He wrote about a secret society that was created by Cecil Rhodes, one of the wealthiest men of all time, comes from England, created a secret society whose sole purpose was to literally conquer the world, not by military means, but by subversion, by intellectual means, by political means, by sociological means, penetrating into the power centers of society, meaning the media, the political parties, and so forth, and controlling the nations of the world from behind the scenes. That was the goal of the secret society created by Cecil Rhodes, and Quigley wrote about it. He was its historian, and you can be sure Clinton knew all about it. And so when Clinton went out of his way at least three times to give honorable mention to Quigley, he was giving a message. To the average person, they thought, oh, well, that's nice. But to the few who knew who Quigley was and what he wrote and what he advocated, they understood Clinton was saying, I know about this master conspiracy, and I am now in its service. The Rhodes Scholarships are nothing but the little surface, a viewable part of a recruiting mechanism to bring people into this secret society. Clinton, of course, was a Rhodes Scholar. And I could go on, but in these books that Quigley wrote, he said, by the way, Quigley himself said, you know, he said, I've studied this organization, I've been given access to its private papers, and I know all about it. And he said, I have no aversion to it or any of its goals. I like it. The only objection, he said, is that I think that it shouldn't remain secret anymore. It should now come out and take credit for all of the things that it has done. And he says in his books, it's been one of the primary, if not the primary, moving historical force in every major event of history since World War I. Can you imagine that? And most people have never even heard of it. And therefore, Quigley says, yeah, it's time to come out and take credit for this. And that's what he wrote about. So one of the things that, and one of the reasons I think Quigley is particularly important is he wrote about the question of how do you control a society. He said, here we are, and by the way, he's a collectivist. He's all in favor of this. He says, here we are. We want to control the world from behind the scenes. That's a good idea, he said. Now, how do we do that and still let people think that they are controlling their own political destiny? How do you do that? We have this thing now. Called democracy.
Yeah, I was going to say the Electoral College.
Yes, and so he raises the question: how do you give people this sensation, the illusion of participating in their own political destiny, while at the same time you are controlling their political destiny from behind the scenes? And he answers the question. He says, very simple: give them two political parties. Let them think that the parties represent different points of view. They battle it out, but we control both parties. Quigley's answer.
Yeah, and that seems pretty obvious to me. And it boggles my mind when people still get caught into this whole Republican-Democrat thing. Oh, Clinton signed this baking bill into effect, and oh, George Bush came out and he tried, you know, he warned the public that this was going to happen, and there's Rush Limbaugh over in the corner squawking that, you know, it's the Democrats, yeah. It's the communists, they're all about all this.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, what is this capitalist, quote-unquote, conspiracy? And, you know, is it really about Democrats and Republicans? Is it about bankers? And, you know, you have a – I recently saw a video, and I believe you have a comic book based on this video called Capitalist Conspiracy. Would you discuss the themes in that video?
Yes, Jan, that, you covered a couple of good points there. I hope I can hold them all in mind and not drop any of them. But first of all, it's not really a comic book. It had a lot of pictures in it, but it's certainly not a comic book. All it is the transcript for the video documentary called The Capitalist Conspiracy. And
thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, but it kind of looks like a comic book because it got so many drawings in it and photographs. But all it is a transcript from a very serious work, which is to show the continuity of the very group that I'm talking about, this Rhodesian group that Quigley was documenting, showing how these very, very powerful people in England and in the United States actually were funding all of the collectivist movements in the world. Now, I use the word collectivist intentionally. I did not say communist, because I want to clarify that when you look at all these words like communism, fascism, Nazism, capitalism, and all these words, they have no meaning. You have to really get very, very precise with meanings. There are really, in the Western world, only two ideological points of view. One is collectivism, and its opponent is individualism. These are words that are not commonly used today, although at the turn of the last century, they were very common in the vocabulary of the American people. But today, they've been lost. I'm trying to bring them back in to use, because they're only ones that mean anything. And communism, fascism, and Nazism, socialism, all of those things are merely variants of collectivism. They're all essentially the same underneath, once you peel off the labels and look at the basic principles. Capitalism is not a constructive opposite of communism or socialism or collectivism in any form. Capitalism, as a matter of fact, is a word which has no meaning to it. It's just used. Karl Marx brought it into popularity by saying the capitalists are the evil people. The capitalists are the ones with the money. They're the ones controlling industry. They're the ones that we have to overthrow. Those are the ones we have to kill in order to purify society. So we think that capitalism is a definable word, but it's not. If you think that capitalism is merely those who control capital, well, then you have to define capital. Is that money, or is that the means of production, or is that natural resources? Well, you have to keep defining and defining and defining, and to finally nobody's in agreement anymore. They thought they knew what capitalism meant, but they don't really know what it means. The ones in the world, at least in the last couple of decades, that had the greatest control over capital were the communists and the socialists. They were astride nations where all capital was in the hands of the political rulers. And they ruled and controlled that capital just like it was their own private personal capital. So the biggest capitalists in the world are the communists and the socialists. So you have to get rid of those words.
Right.
Individualism versus collectivism are the only words. Well, so I went on to that little sidetrack because I was saying that in this documentary called The Capitalist Conspiracy, I was using the word as Marx used it, meaning those with great wealth. And we find out that the ones with great wealth are the ones who really were enemies of private enterprise and free enterprise. The great capitalists of the last decades, like the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and those people, they hated free enterprise. They wanted government influence. They wanted monopolies backed by government law. They wanted cartels like the Federal Reserve System backed by government law. They wanted to be partners with the government. They wanted to control the government. But they hated competition. Now, they got, in the early days, they rose to positions of power through competitive means, in many cases very unscrupulous, but nevertheless, they used competition to rise to the top. But once they got there, they wanted no more competition. Now, they wanted the government to step in and pass laws to prevent competition from those who might come up and dislodge them from the top of the mountain. So the so-called capitalists of that period were not capitalists in the sense of free enterprise capitalists. They were monopoly capitalists. And that was one of the themes that I was trying to bring out in that documentary.
Well, you know, and you mentioned Karl Marx earlier and his sort of creating this theme of capitalism. You talk of banks funding both sides of wars and communism itself. What evidence is there that these bankers have actually that they funded the Bolshevik Revolution and the creation of the communist state itself, much less the writing of Karl Marx's book to begin with? Wasn't even he paid by a group of guys to write that book as a sort of spearhead into the public with these ideas?
Well, yes, Karl Marx was funded by very wealthy people. he was funded by the very capitalists that he was condemning.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But you see, as I mentioned a moment ago, not everybody with money is a free enterprise supporter. The capitalists that supported Karl Marx and the capitalists that funded the Bolshevik Revolution believed in state control. They believed in having control over the economy and over the people. That's what communism is all about.
All the Ayn Rand fans out there are just rolling in their cars, rolling wherever they roll out in L.A. There's so many Ayn Rand Atlas Shrugged fans out there, and it's, you know, the whole premise of her book is really destroyed when you realize that it was these bankers and everything that funded the entire communist revolution, and doesn't that invalidate the whole thing?
Well, I'll let the Ayn Randers speak for themselves, but I have a feeling that if there were any of them on the line right now, they would challenge that statement. I think they would say that the heroes of Ayn Rand were not the monopoly capitalists at all, but were the free enterprisers, the ones that did not want government control or intervention of any kind.
Right.
That's what I would think.
But didn't she base the figure of John Galt on J.P. Morgan or Andrew Carnegie?
Oh, a good question. I don't know.
The whole steel railroad theme in the book really just screams to me that this is all about J.P. Morgan and crew.
Oh, well, I'll have to plead ignorance on that one. I do know that the John Galt that she portrayed in her book was nothing like Andrew Carnegie. I can say that, except for the fact that they both were involved in steel.
Right. Well, you know, I guess the point is really it's a mythic hero figure that doesn't exist. You know, these people that got to where they are, you know, they didn't get there by, you know, these kindly competitions and everybody was, I mean, you know, they got there by coups and assassinations and takeovers and, you know, and good strong competition in the meantime. But, you know, I would be, I mean, if the idealistic hero figure in her works even exists anywhere on the planet, I think that person should be brought forward and paraded about because I don't believe it.
Yeah, well, I'm not here to defend those works. I did read them years ago, and I was influenced by them. And I certainly agree with Rand's identification of the conflict between individualism and collectivism.
Right.
She did an outstanding job of that, and it's something I think more people have to, you know, think about and become more proficient with these words. Because I have found that although occasionally I'll run into a few real die-hard collectivists who are prepared to stand their ground and debate the issues right down to the minutiae, most people come out and say, you know, I never thought about that before. But, you know, the more I think about it, the more I think you're right. Individualism is far superior to collectivism. And I think that most people, given a chance to to examine the rationale for these conflicting points of view will certainly sign in on the side of individualism and reject collectivism in all of its forms,
right,
whether it's communism, Nazism, fascism, or New Dealism, or or anything we want to even call Americanism today. That word has been twisted around, you know?
Right.
It's collectivism must be rejected. In my view, only one or the other, freedom or collectivism, is going to survive in the long run. One or the other has got to go.
Let me ask you, and I did interrupt you earlier when you were talking about the whole Bolshevik thing, but I don't know if you were finished with that or...
Well, I've forgotten where I was now. I sort of ramble. You did have some really good points there on the capitalist conspiracy. I just wanted to clarify that when I used the word the capitalist conspiracy in that title, in retrospect, I wish I hadn't, because it raises too many questions. But when I did use it, I did not mean it in the sense that most Americans think of capitalism.
Understood. And let me ask you this: What do you feel are the were the limitations in your research, and where else would you like to cover, or where would you have covered if you could go back again?
Well, I'd be a fool to say there were no limitations. I feel them everywhere, and most of them relate to my limitations of time. You know, this project was supposed to be maybe a 4 or 5 month project, and it turned out to be 12 years.
Well, and, you're still on the same project right now, aren't you?
I'm still pursuing it. I'm still learning about it. And I remember I had to get out of town to do my writing, and I used to go up into the mountains and pack away for a week or two at a time. And I'd always put everything in those banker boxes that I mentioned earlier. That's how I organize my stuff, is in banker boxes. So I'd haul these banker boxes up and down the mountain and go to this cabin back in the woods, and I'd write it away, write away. Finally, after, you know, 7 years of this stuff, I came to the point and said, hey, Griffin, you're through. This is it. I was only about halfway through the story, I thought. I hadn't even dealt with World War II or anything after that period, and that was a lot of interesting action there, but I was looking at my manuscript. I already had a 600-page book, and I said, wait a minute. You know, nobody wants to read all this stuff. If you haven't made your point by now, you're not going to make it in another 300 pages, so just close it off and get it out. And it's a good thing I did, because I was correct in my analysis. Nobody wants to read a 600-page book. But anyway, back to your point.
I wouldn't say no one, but yeah, go ahead. Back to the point.
The limitations are time. There are so many more examples of the fraud of the Federal Reserve System that can be demonstrated in the history following World War I, which is essentially where I closed it off. And certainly the history is unfolding today. I think what's happened in the last 5 months probably is the basis for a whole book in itself. So the limitations are time. But nevertheless, once you've demonstrated the point that the system was based upon fraud and that it operates on the mechanism of fraud, then you shouldn't be surprised when fraud is the result. And once people get that picture, then I think they don't need to go any further unless they're just curious.
Meyerhoff is really the standard or the rule, not the exception, in other words.
I didn't hear the first word. What was that?
Meyerhoff, this guy that had this Ponzi scheme for all these billions of dollars, that's really the standard, not the exception to the rule.
Oh, yes, I have to agree, unfortunately. Yeah.
And
so many Ponzi schemes out there, it's ridiculous.
You know, and there was another huge one that happened, I think, the week, I can't remember his name, the week of Obama's inauguration, I believe, or right thereabouts, and that one was almost entirely swept under the radar by the media, and it was equally as large as Meyerhoff's, but because this guy was close friends of Obama's and the administration, it was very quietly laid to rest.
Oh, well, see, I was not aware of that either.
I have an email about it somewhere. I'll dig it up and I'll forward it to you. Are you aware of Fritz Springmeier's book, Bloodlines of the Illuminati? And if so, how does his work affect your own work?
I'm not familiar with that, no.
That's one that I would highly recommend. And in fact, my copy just came today because so many people, a few of my good friends have been telling me that I've got to read it. So I located a copy that wasn't several hundred dollars. I actually found one for $40, and I plan to start reading that today right after this interview. But I've heard a lot about that book. Let me ask you this. With everything that you've laid out and with all of your information and your book, what is the solution and how do we get ourselves out of this mess?
I alluded to this solution a moment ago when I said we need a good recession to clean
right.
out the garbage, to get all the toxic stuff out of our system. It means some banks have to fail. Some companies have to fail.
Doesn't that mean, though, the Citibanks and the AIGs of the world as well?
They should fail. Why should they be bailed out when if my company fails, nobody's going to bail me out? I wouldn't dream of asking the government to go take money away from you and give it to me because I made some bad business decisions. Why would I expect a bank or any other industry, a manufacturer of automobiles, or any other company to have coercive power to take money from me or you so that they can make up for their bad business decisions? It's foreign to concept of justice and logic. And the argument, of course, that the collectivists would come up with, as they always do, is, well, it's in the best interest of society. It's in the long run the best interest for everyone, the greatest good of the greatest number. Well, we can't get along without banks, can we? The economy would fail, wouldn't it? We'd need automobiles, don't we? These people need employment, don't they? And so they always look at the short, immediate consequences instead of the long-term consequences. But anyway, now we're slipping into that discussion of the difference between individualism and collectivism.
Right.
My view as an individualist is that the fraudulent systems, and they are, and the failing systems, the inefficient systems, should fail. And the losses should be written off, and then we should start fresh with a new slate, and the ability to build without government regulations and controls, which is what got us into the mess in the first place. And now we'll go back and rebuild our system and make it better than it ever was. But if we don't do that, we'll just continue to keep going down that same path, which, as I mentioned earlier, is headed only one place, and that's totalitarianism. To me, the option is very easy. The choice is very easy.
I couldn't agree with you more. And let me ask you, Edward, what is the single most important facet of your research that you would like people to take away from this interview?
I think the most important thing is perhaps the most general view, and that is that things are not necessarily what they appear to be, that the official view as promulgated by our government leaders, spokesmen, and by the media is not a reflection of reality. And that as long as we rely on the pre-established authorities to tell us what's going on, to tell us what to think, there's no hope for us. In order for us to be a free people, we have to be skeptical. We have to be strong. We have to be disciplined to do our own thinking, our own research, and we have to be able to stand up against authority if necessary, if we think the authority is corrupt. I guess the message, or the one thing I want to leave, is that it's time for Americans to become Americans once again.
Thank you. That's very well said. And Do you have, would you like to mention your other books, your website, any contact information or anything like that? Maybe you'd like to discuss your, or mention your book, World Without Cancer, before we close this up?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that opportunity. Yeah, we do have, we have three sites, actually, that I'd like people to become familiar with. First of all, we have a weekly news service, and it's called Unfiltered News, and I personally publish that. I compile it every week, and it's free, and anybody that wants to be tuned in to what we think is the unfiltered news of the world for that week, it's easy to get hold of. You come to our website called therealityzone.com. Now, realityzone.com is a commercial website. We sell books and recordings, videotapes there, and you'll find over 100 items, including The Creature from Jekyll Island, which we've been talking about, World Without Cancer, which is my book on cancer, and a whole bunch of my other books and videotapes and audio recordings, plus a lot of things produced by other people as well, and that's realityzone.com. And on the main page, there's a figure of a little guy reading a newspaper, an icon of a newspaper reader, and that will take you to the unfiltered news section. And there you can check out a sample copy, look at some of our previous copies, and see if you like what you see. And then if you like it, you can sign up absolutely free at that point. For the thinkers and the doers who want to do something about these things that are going on in the world, we have another site. It's called freedomforceinternational.org. freedomforceinternational.org. That's an organization I created in 2002. It's truly international, as the name says. We have members now in 60 countries, and the purpose of our organization is to build an international network of people who are resolved to take back control over their political systems and return it, in many cases return it, in other cases to move it toward freedom. And we intend to do this by becoming influential in the power centers of society, not just complaining about the problems, not petitioning, not carrying placards, although many people will do that. Our job is to help each other actually become in positions of influence in the power centers of society, meaning the political parties, the media centers, church organizations, labor unions, you name it, wherever organizations exist which carry political influence, that's where we want our members to be active to deliver the freedom message. And that, in a nutshell, is the whole purpose of Freedom Force. We know that, that without power, you can't accomplish anything. We've got to reach for power. And just reading books and complaining and writing letters of petition is not going to do it until we have the power to move society. The motto of Freedom Force International is In potentes libertatem defendere non potunt, which translated means those without power cannot defend freedom. So that's it in a nutshell. The doers and shakers will come to freedomforceinternational.org, and the people that want more information to learn more about what's going on in the world and learn about what we think will come to realityzone.com, and there, if they want to sign up for the free weekly news service, Unfiltered News, they will find it on the front page.
Great. And, you know, one of your website projects reminds me of one that I'm sort of a part of right now, which a friend of mine is launching here soon, and this will ring a bell with you. It will be tragedyandhope.com, and that will be a magazine publication as well. And we've been listening to G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. And, Edward, I really appreciate the time you've taken with me today and the extra half an hour that you gave my audience with this wonderful and detailed information. And I look forward to your future projects and emails as well.
Well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate the invitation, and I hope that it's been worthwhile.
Oh, it definitely has.
Wake up! Won't you listen to me? Wake up! Won't you listen to me? Won't you listen to me? Wake up!